Successful people come in all ages, shapes, sizes, and colors, but they all have one thing in common, a winning attitude. The attitude we habitually present to the world can be controlled by you and me. We determine our attitude when we get up in the morning and set out on a new day. And our days, all the years of our lives, will usually reflect and give us back what we really expect.
It's appropriate, I think, that attitude is the first subject in a collection which celebrates the uncommon ideas of an exceptional man, Earl Nightingale. Beginning in his youth, he was unflinching in his resolve to find out why some people were happy and others weren't, why some were successful and others seemed eager to settle for mediocrity. The search continued throughout his life, the last 36 years of it gladly spent in sharing his discoveries with millions through radio and television, records, books, and cassettes. The six words Earl called the strangest secret became the nucleus for an explosion in the field of personal development learning. They don't sound too revolutionary, but in a complex world, their very simplicity warrants Earl's label of strange. Those six words, we become what we think about. And a major element, whether you want to call it a cause or a result of what we think about, is that magic word, attitude. Hello, I'm Steve King. It was my pleasure to know and work with Earl Nightingale for a number of years, and I'm pleased now to serve as your host for this collection of themes on living a fuller, richer life. To begin our exploration of important ideas, we'll examine attitude, the one thing that comes very close to being everything about success or failure. And we'll learn about the five areas of life where successful people experience more joy and satisfaction because of their attitudes. Earl once said, "A great attitude does much more than turn on the lights and bring up the music in our worlds. It seems to magically connect us to all sorts of opportunities that were somehow absent before the change." But in order to take full advantage of these wonderful opportunities, there must be an energy, an enthusiasm that will transform our attitudes into action. Soon we discover the incredible rewards inherent in being of service to others, and find that the highest form of service in whatever we do is that which is done with a goal toward excellence. We'll also look at ways to build a good attitude, unleashing its amazing power and thereby unlocking the doors to success in every area of life.
We live in a world of words. No matter what something happens to be, we have a word for it. And some words mean a great deal to us. Words such as love, happiness, success, achievement, joy, ability. These words describe conditions all of us want. But there's one word that controls them all. That is, there's one word that describes a condition that will bring us all of these things or keep us from getting any one of them. It's been called the most important word on earth. If your youngster asks you what this word is, could you tell him? And if from all the many thousands of words in the language you were asked to select the one that would influence your life more than any other, could you pick the right word? I call it the magic word, and I've talked about it before. In our language, it's pronounced attitude. Once we're grown and on our own, this word actually controls our environment, our entire world. You see, if your attitude toward the world is good, you'll obtain good results. If your attitude is excellent, you'll obtain excellent results. And if your attitude is just so-so, well, you'll live in a world that is not particularly bad nor particularly good, just so-so. Now, if you're curious about what kind of an attitude you have, a simple test will tell you what your attitude's been up to this point in your life. Just answer this question with a yes or no. Do you feel the world is treating you well? If your answer is a quick yes, your attitude is good. If your answer is no, your attitude is bad. And if you have trouble deciding, your attitude is probably average. You see, our environment, which is another way of saying how the world treats us, is nothing more than a reflection, a merciless mirror, actually, of our own attitude. One of the most pitiful aspects of society is the really large percentage of people who lead dismal, narrow, darkened lives, crying out against what appears to be a cruel world that they believe has singled them out for an existence of trouble, misery, and bad luck. Our attitude will determine whether we tend to be lucky or not. People who expect to be lucky, who expect good things to happen to them more often than bad, actually go through life from one piece of good fortune to another. Now, I know there are cynics who don't believe all of this, but it's true all the same, and it's been proved hundreds of thousands of times. It doesn't mean you can pick the winner at the track or bet on the right team. There are too many variables in such things. But we get from life what we tend to expect from it. We do the things we make up our minds to do, live in the towns or areas we want to live in, and work at the jobs of our choice once we learn the magic of putting our minds and attitudes to work in our lives. The person with the attitude that he can't do something will seldom do it. The person who believes he can does. Perhaps not the first time, but his attitude gives him the confidence to stay with it until it's been accomplished. When I was starting out to build my business, I used to call on advertising agencies in Chicago. I met a lot of receptionists and telephone operators. I'd give my greeting and ask how they felt, and I recall hearing on several occasions, in fact, most of the time, the response, "I'm tired." I'd say, "Well, it's only 10 o'clock in the morning. How can you be tired already? No sleep last night?" "No," the receptionist would say, "I got plenty of sleep. I'm just tired in the mornings." These people had tired attitudes. They expected to be tired, but if they were leaving on vacation that morning or a special weekend were coming up, chances are they'd get up feeling great. Nearly every time I've started something of some size and risk, I've had people tell me not to try. "You'll just lose your shirt," they'd say. They had losing attitudes. I never gave it a thought, and you'll find that typical of people who get things done. They may proceed with great caution and care and go to great lengths to avoid making any unnecessary mistakes, but they fully intend to win, and when they do, with an attitude of failure, we're whipped before we start. Successful people come in all ages, shapes, sizes, and colors, but they all have one thing in common, a winning attitude. I ran across a quotation by Norman Cousins I thought you'd find interesting. He said, "The prime fallacy of pessimism is that no one knows enough to be a pessimist." I'm sure a pessimist would counter with the remark that if that's true, no one knows enough to be an optimist, but this would not change the truth of the former thought. The prime fallacy of pessimism is that no one knows enough to be a pessimist. And regardless of whether this is also true of the optimist, we do know that over the long haul, we tend to get what we expect from life. Because we tend to get what we really expect from life, it makes a lot of sense to choose to be optimistic rather than pessimistic. How many times have you heard someone say, or perhaps have said yourself, "With my kind of luck, such and such is bound to happen," indicating that your luck is generally bad and that you expect the worst. Even when people find themselves enjoying a sudden stroke of good fortune, they'll often say, "Well, it's too good to last," again indicating that they expect their fortunes in life to be generally bad. Now, this must be a hangover from times going back to the Dark Ages, and perhaps before, when life was 1,000 times more precarious than it is today. As recently as 100 years ago, if you cut your toe and blood poisoning, as it was called, set in, you could be a goner. The mortality rate for children was astronomical and almost as high for adults. If a person reached his 30th birthday, it called for a real celebration. In fact, birthday celebrations for any age took on importance simply because getting from one to another was no little achievement. Now, couple this with the almost total ignorance of the times, widespread illiteracy, and lives governed by superstition, and you can understand why people tended to be slightly on the pessimistic side, but that's in the past. And even then, it was the optimists who were responsible for what little forward movement occurred. Pessimists aren't builders. They're more often stumbling blocks. Instead of looking for the reasons something can be done or tried, they tend to look for reasons why it won't work. A pessimist is a real reactionary. He tends to go backward. He resists anything new and untried. He's the person who says the bottle is half empty instead of half full, or that the weather is partly cloudy instead of partly sunny. He dwells on his past failures and forgets his successes. He'll come up with 100 reasons for not doing something instead of a single good reason for doing it. He likes to say no to people, and as a result, says no to life. And getting back to that quote of Norman Cousins, perhaps the biggest fault of a pessimist is that he thinks he knows more than he does. He doesn't know about the power of enthusiasm and a good attitude. He won't move forward until all the lights ahead turn green, and thus never moves, because all the lights are never green at any one time. A person has to learn to be a pessimist. Children are the most wonderful optimists and think anything at all is possible. It must be in the home that so much of this natural enthusiasm dies or is killed. As George Santayana said, we must welcome the future, remembering that soon it will be the past. And we must respect the past, remembering that once it was all that was humanly possible. Let me quote something to you found in Carl Sandburg's account of the Kansas Sodbuster. Who was that early sodbuster in Kansas? He leaned at the gatepost and studied the horizon and figured what corn might do next year and tried to calculate why God ever made the grasshopper and why 2 days of hot winds smothered the life out of a stand of wheat and why there was such a spread between what he got for grain and the price quoted in Chicago and New York. Drove up a newcomer in a covered wagon. What kind of folks live around here? Well, stranger, what kind of folks was there in the country you come from? Well, there was mostly a low-down, lying, thieving, gossiping, backbiting lot of people. Well, I guess, stranger, that's about the kind of folks you'll find around here. And the dusty gray stranger had just about blended into the dusty gray cottonwoods in a clump on the horizon when another newcomer drove up. What kind of folks live around here? Well, stranger, what kind of folks was there in the country you came from? Well, there was mostly a decent, hard-working, law-abiding, friendly lot of people. Well, I guess, stranger, that's about the kind of folks you'll find around here. And the second wagon moved off and blended with the dusty gray cottonwoods on the horizon while the early sodbuster leaned at his gatepost and tried to figure out why 2 days of hot winds smothered the life out of a nice stand of wheat. Noel McGinnis tells us that what Carl Sandburg is telling us here is that the world cooperates with us by conforming to our expectations of it. The classic example of this is, of course, the paranoid who suspects that everyone's against him and who therefore relates to people in such a way that they're bound to be against him. Psychologists have demonstrated that our idea of reality is determined by our perception of things, the way our senses interpret things, rather than the way things really are. Edward T. Hall has written that the relationship between man and the cultural dimension is one in which both man and his environment participate in molding each other. Man is now in the position of actually creating the total world in which he lives. In creating this world, he is actually determining what kind of an organism he'll be. Carl Sandburg, Dorothy Lee, Benjamin Lee Whorf, Edward Hall, and numerous others have told us, in essence, that we create our own space. Now, what does this mean? Well, as with Albert Einstein, it means that space is relative. Unlike Newtonian physicists, Einstein did not conceive of space as an absolute entity in relation to which things are organized. Quite the contrary, he defined space as the relationship that exists among things as a result of their organization. Well, a tendency for reality to be a self-fulfilling prophecy rather than an absolute given has been explained by some modern anthropologists. Dorothy Lee does a good job of it in Freedom and Culture. And what all this means for you and me is that our individual worlds will respond to us in the way in which we see them. They will become for us what we expect of them. We are the creators of our own surroundings. To ask what role does attitude play in a person's success or failure is a lot like asking, what role does granite play in the Himalayas? Or what role does a good parent play in the home? The answer is, attitude is the very foundation for success. But the majority of people in the United States are not successful people in any of the fundamental categories that make a difference. What are these important categories? One, recognition. Successful people give more recognition to others than do unsuccessful people. Two, self-esteem. This comes in part from recognition, and it also comes from the knowledge that one is in charge of his or her life and that it's proceeding along its planned route. Number three, rewards. The rewards of success come in many forms, not the least of which is in the form of money. Successful people earn more money than unsuccessful people and enjoy investing and spending it. They live in better dwellings, drive better cars, they travel more, they meet more interesting people, and have infinitely more options. Successful people don't have to spend the final years of their lives, which for successful people are usually the best years of their lives, in limited or unfortunate circumstances. Successful people tend to enjoy life more and tend to enjoy more of their years. Number four, change. The stimulation of change in our lives is of great importance. In fact, some experts in such matters believe change to be the second most important want on the part of people everywhere, right after recognition. Successful people have much more stimulation and change in their lives. They can go more places, do more things, meet more people. They're not stuck anywhere. Number five, service. Successful people do a better job of serving others than do unsuccessful people, or they would not be successful. Their very success gives them more options and more freedom to be of service to others through foundations, libraries, hospitals, universities, the arts. The successful people of the country serve without fanfare by giving their time and money to charitable organizations of all kinds. To me, these are the five main categories in which the successful experience joy, satisfaction, and reward, and the unsuccessful do not.
So, valuable byproducts of a good attitude, the fundamental categories that make a difference, recognition and self-esteem. We give others more of ourselves when we share these precious commodities. Rewards. Successful people reap more rewards from life, and they grow to expect and enjoy the stimulation from constant change. And finally, service. We'll talk more about this vital part of our lives on the next side of this cassette. Just as in the Carl Sandburg example Earl mentioned a moment ago, we get back from our world what we expect from it. If one has a hearty, positive attitude, he lives in a wonderful world, a world of endless possibilities. And he's able to act on those possibilities with enthusiasm. This person finds it in himself, gets it from others, and gives it away liberally. It's a zest for life, a way to keep routine things from seeming routine, and a readiness for the next opportunity to fulfill his potential.
The saddest days of our lives are those days in which we can find nothing to be enthusiastic about. I think you can say that a person's enthusiasm is in direct proportion to the importance of what it is he's looking forward to. Thus, there are all sorts of degrees of enthusiasm. People tend to be mildly enthusiastic on Fridays simply because it's the last day of the week and they've got a free weekend coming up. People tend to be more enthusiastic about going home after work at night than they are about leaving for work in the morning. But the most fortunate people on earth are those who live most of their lives in a state of energizing enthusiasm. And you know what the key to enthusiasm is? Well, there are two keys, really. One comes from learning, the other comes from accomplishment. Learning new things tends to keep our enthusiasm high. Perhaps this explains the natural enthusiasm of children. If you've paid much attention to children, you've noticed that they're naturally enthusiastic and they're naturally happy. The reason adults tend to lose a lot of their enthusiasm for living is that they usually stop learning. As soon as school's over, they take the stand, consciously or unconsciously, that they know enough. Any learning they do from that point on, they do passively through the natural passage of time and experience, or again, passively through the media, newspapers, radio, and television. If new learning comes to them, it does so largely through no efforts, or at least minimal efforts on their part. Learning little that is new or interesting, their lives become repetitious and settle down into well-worn grooves. They see the same people and go through the same motions every day, and gradually or quickly or all or most of the enthusiasm fades from their lives. The second key usually ties in with the first, the second key being accomplishment. It's pretty hard to accomplish something new without first learning something new, even if the accomplishment is limited to improving one's golf game or making furniture in the basement. But we're enthusiastic when we're working on a project we want to complete or master. The key word there is want. It has to be something we want very much to do, as opposed to those duties and projects we must do whether we like them or not. Did you ever get a good look at a dog's face when he's chasing a rabbit? It's the happiest, most alert expression you'll ever see in your life. He's got something wonderfully worthwhile to do, and he's having the time of his life trying to do it. You'd hardly know it was the same dog you saw snoozing and twitching on the back porch before the rabbit came into the picture. He couldn't even keep his eyes open then. It's the same with people. The rabbit may be different for each of us, but it's our job to flush it out. The word enthusiasm comes from the Greek word entheos, which means the God within. And the happiest, most interesting people are those who have found the secret of maintaining their enthusiasm, that God within.
I'd like to read something to you that was written back in the year 1917. It was written by Bruce Barton, who lived to head one of the world's largest advertising agencies and who also won a seat in the United States House of Representatives. The fact that this story was written in 1917 is not important. It's as true today as it was then. Bruce Barton wrote, "A little while ago, I was in charge of a large organization of salesmen. My chief sent me to a Midwestern city to appoint a manager for that territory. There were two candidates. We had their records in detail, but we had never met either of them. I was to look them over, form my judgment, and appoint the better man. I met one in Cincinnati, the other in St. Louis. The man in Cincinnati said to me, 'What does this position pay?' I told him, 'That's more than I'm getting here,' he said, 'and I should like the job. Every man wants to better himself when he can.' The St. Louis man did not wait for me to arrive in the city. He found out what train I was coming on, rode out on the line, and surprised me by walking down the aisle of my car. He began to talk. He told me about himself, his training, and his selling experience. He'd drawn up plans in detail for the development of our territory. He told me how many men he expected to have working by the end of the year, and just how he thought he could increase our volume of business. I had to hire him, finally, in order to get a chance to go to bed that night. And in his enthusiasm, he forgot to ask me, and I forgot to tell him, what the salary would be. The first man had wanted a better job, which is commendable enough. But I hired the man who was enthusiastic about the opportunity. Napoleon's adversaries used to speak of him as the 100,000 man, meaning that his spirit infused into an army was equal to an additional 100,000 troops. They criticized his tactics. They accused him of disregarding all the rules of successful warfare, yet he won, and they lost, because his enthusiasm carried his soldiers to impossible achievements. Encourage your children to express their enthusiasm and delight. Let them believe that the world is full of wonderful things, and they themselves full of splendid possibilities. They can learn self-repression in later years, but enthusiasm, once lost, is lost forever. Men are nothing, said Montaigne, until they're excited, and Montaigne was right. Well, that's the story that Bruce Barton wrote in 1917, but you could haul it out 100 years from now and its lesson would be just as valuable. We should never lose our zest for living, our excitement and enthusiasm, our curiosity and our desire to know. The person who does is certainly blind to the world, its miracles and possibilities, and his own possibilities. And when we put a damper on a child's enthusiasm, we're repressing one of his most valuable emotions. You know, the world is as exciting today as it was when we were children. The trouble lies in the fact that we tend to lose our children's eyes, and because of it, our enthusiasm for life.
As we heard, constant learning keeps our enthusiasm high. And directly related to learning is accomplishment. All the days of our lives, the absorption of new information stimulates us to action, to accomplishment. The tremendous feeling that accomplishment brings allows us to zero in on our desires, our goals, and new ways to serve others. As we'll learn in our next session, the opportunity to serve is one we shouldn't pass up. Service to our families, customers, friends, and our world isn't a chore. It's part of the joy of living, if we have a good attitude. In our time together here, we'll learn about service. Is it an obligation? A responsibility? Can we actually be personally enriched by helping others? Listening with an open mind, you'll be able to come to your own conclusions and start making your own connection between your attitude and your service to others. In 1988, Earl was the subject of a candid audio interview. Seated in front of that microphone, a very familiar and comfortable place for him, he spoke of his life's work and the beliefs that energized his long and active career. The talk naturally turned to one of Earl's favorite subjects, mankind and the will to serve.
The idea of service is all-encompassing. We cannot overestimate the idea of service. It's everything. All of our income, tangible and psychic. Psychic income is the joy we know from the kind of work we do. It's the home we live in. It's the wonderful family we have. It's the everything about our lives that you can't nail against a wall. It's all the joy of living, really. The most important part of living is the psychic part of living. But all of our rewards, all of our income, tangible and psychic, will come from making the best use of what we are as learning, growing, thinking, imagining, productive creatures in the service of others. It's not to stand still. It's not to think, I'm good enough now. I've got enough education. I don't need to learn anymore. Quite often, as it's been pointed out, Americans have the vaccination theory of education. They say, I got a degree. Now I don't need to study anymore. I'm already educated. And that's usually at the point they stop serving. Learning, education is a lifelong process. We should come to the end of our days still learning interesting and exciting and wonderful things. One of the most astonishing things to me is how anyone in this world can ever be bored when there are so many amazing and wonderful and exciting and interesting things to do and to think about and books to read and things to see. I just can't understand it. But that's what happens to people who stop learning too soon. But the idea of service is that all of our income of any kind comes to us from making the best use of what we are as learning, growing, thinking, imagining, productive creatures in the service of others. The homemaker, for example, who serves her husband and her children. She serves the friends of hers that she knows, her neighbors, through just knowing her, through the joy of knowing her and from the joy she gives them. She serves her local church, perhaps, in her community in other ways, in the PTA, and she serves in innumerable ways. Maybe she won't serve that many, but the quality of her service is what counts, and that's where the joy of her life will come from, the quality of her service. You know, they say it isn't the amount of time we spend with our children that's important, it's the quality of that time. But it's service doing what you want to do. It's service. The reason you want to do a certain thing is because your genetic profile is pointing you in that direction. Your genes are telling you that is exactly what you do best. It may be better than anybody else, or maybe you're in a top 5 or 10% category of all the people in the world who do this particular thing, and that's wonderful. And you can make a real contribution in this field. Each of us has something that he or she is especially good at. And that's what we should find and throw ourselves into it in the service of others. Let's talk about responsibility.
It isn't necessarily a responsibility, but I think most people are born with a natural impulse to be of service. I think we want to serve. You see a little girl acting out like her mother, putting dishes on the table or putting them away, you know, or vacuuming or dressing her doll or bathing it. She's being of service. That's what we're basically for. The most important, I think, for an individual is to find what he or she wants to do. I think that's the most important thing. And then to understand that his or her rewards will be determined by the extent of the service rendered. So let me give you that quote again, what I call the idea of service. All of our income, and this is the thing to remember by everyone, a youngster, older person, it applies to everybody. All of our income, tangible and psychic, will come from making the best use of what we are as learning, growing, thinking, imagining, productive creatures in the service of others. How would you answer the question, why are you here? Go ahead, ask the question, ask, why am I here? Do you know? Dr. Albert Einstein was asked to answer that question, and he did. Do you know what he said? Well, I'll get to it in a moment. You know, it's been said that if the universe is an accident, we are accidents. But if there's meaning in the universe, then there's meaning in us also. And since it is believed that Dr. Einstein understood more about the laws governing the universe than any person who ever lived up until his time, let's go to him for some answers. He believed there was some sort of meaning in the way things are. He was sure of it. He said, "The more I study physics, the more I'm drawn toward metaphysics." The word metaphysics simply means beyond physics, the study of what is beyond measure, the invisible forces at work. Getting back to Einstein, if you haven't done so, you would enjoy reading Einstein, The Life and Times by Ronald W. Clark. Albert Einstein was so remarkable a man that it was as if he had arrived on this planet through some mistake in celestial navigation, and as a result, devoted his life to solving the problems of time and space so that the mistake would not be repeated. Dr. Einstein belonged to no formal religion or sect. Yet, he was a deeply religious man in the cosmic sense. He believed that such magnificence and colossal order, the great cyclotron of the universe, as Ronald Clark puts it, could not have been an accident. And he addressed himself to the purpose of life. He answered the question, "Why am I here?" as well as it has been answered, I believe, when he said, "Man is here for the sake of other men only." Now, he used the word man in its classical sense, the idiomatic man, meaning human beings of both sexes, of course. So he said that we are here for the sake of others only. Is that the way you would have answered it? Do you believe that you are here solely to serve others and, through serving others, are being served and enjoying life as a result? We are here for the sake of serving others only. And to the extent that we serve others, well, we know the joy of living. To many, that'll sound silly and square, but that's what it comes down to, nevertheless. And sometimes it takes a long time to learn the truth of it. Millions never learn it and grow old in querulous discontent, wondering what went wrong with their lives. Our rewards in life will always be in direct proportion to our contribution. This is the law that stands as the supporting structure of all economics and of our personal well-being. Unfortunately, most people either don't know about this wonderful rule or think that somehow it applies only to the other guy. Most people believe we should have speed limit signs too, but that they're for other people who don't know how to drive as well as they do. Let's get back to the law of rewards equaling contributions. The law's in operation all the time, whether or not we know about it or go along with it. It's like an apothecary scale, you know the kind, with a cross arm on top from which depend two bowls on chains, a delicate and honest mechanism. Let's label one of the bowls rewards and the other one contributions. Most people concentrate on the bowl-marked rewards. That is, they want things, more money, a better home, education for the kids, travel, retirement, so on, all rewards. They're hungering for the rewards. But the rewards aren't materializing because they're forgetting the bowl-marked contributions. In other words, they're concentrating on the wrong bowl. They're like the man who sat in front of the stove and said, "Give me heat, and then I'll give you wood." He could sit there until he froze to death. Stoves don't work that way, and neither does life or economics. We can actually forget about the bowl-marked rewards. All we have to do is concentrate on the bowl-marked contributions. Life and basic economics will automatically take care of the rewards. It's a fact that most people have this backward. Now, what do we mean by contribution, and to whom do we contribute? You can define contribution as the time you devote to whatever it is you do and the degree of excellence you put into it. And your contribution is to mankind, and mankind can be defined as the people you serve. So you can break it all down to a simple equation. Your rewards will be determined by the way you do your job, multiplied by the number of people you serve. In our exploding economy today, if a person isn't happy with his rewards, he should take a good long look at his contributions. This may seem like a hard, cruel way of looking at things, but laws are good or bad only in the way we look at them. If you feel you're being held back in life, or that you're not getting enough of the things you should, to paraphrase the late John F. Kennedy, ask not what you can get, but what you can do. What you can contribute to the causes and people it is given you to serve. Your rewards, believe me, will always take care of themselves.
There's something I want to run by you again. All of our rewards, all of our income, both tangible and psychic, will come from making the best use of what we are as learning, thinking, imagining, productive creatures in the service of others. I think it's important to remember that everybody has special skills and talents which can be put to work in the service of others, like the homemaker in Earl's example. And as he mentioned, a lot of people forget that simple law. Or maybe they forget that it's in operation all the time. The law again: our rewards in life will always be in direct proportion to our contribution. Now we'll hear some of the wisdom of Dr. Albert Schweitzer applied to the subject of maximizing our service. In addition, we'll consider how getting rich in any area of your life can only be achieved by giving more than you receive.
Here are a few thoughts that you can make your own. Thoughts, if you do make them your own, that will guarantee your success all the years of your life. Now, that's quite a statement, but it's true. Now, to begin, let's understand that growth and increase are a part of mankind and all of nature. It's inherent in each of us to desire more. This isn't wrong. It's perfectly natural in the way it should be. This is true of all of us, the members of our families, our friends and associates, our customers. You should want to get rich in every department of your life. But what do I mean by rich? Getting rich for you is getting what you want very much. For some, it means a bigger income or a large sum of capital. That's fine. You can get it without hurting or even competing with any other person. In fact, you can thereby increase the general well-being of everyone with whom you come in contact. Unfortunately, the uninformed believe that you can get ahead in the world only at the expense of someone else. This isn't true. No one can become rich in any way without serving others. Anyone who adds to prosperity must prosper in turn. Getting rich for you may mean obtaining more love, greater peace of mind, owning the home of your dreams, or accomplishing something else you've set your heart upon. In short, getting rich is getting whatever it is you want very much. It's as simple as that. Now, the first step is to understand completely that it's right for you to want what you want. All human activities are based on the desire for increase. People seeking more food, more clothes, more knowledge, more pleasure, more life. The next step is to understand that you need not compete with or deprive anyone. Don't compete. Create. In this way, you add to the general well-being without taking anything away from anyone. Remember to give to every person more than you take from him. Now, at first, this may sound absurd, so let's dig into it a little. In order for a business or a person to expand, and remember expansion is the natural desire of mankind, we must give more in use value than we charge. A building nail doesn't cost much, yet its use is great and goes on for years. This cassette didn't cost much, yet if you can get ideas from it that can bring you more than you now have, its use value will greatly exceed its cost. How much does it cost to give love, respect, and consideration to those near you? Very little, just a little extra effort. Yet love, respect, and consideration are priceless to the person receiving them. This is the key. Give more than you receive in everything you do. In this way, you're building a great credit for yourself that must come to you in some form, sooner or later. You are taking out less than you're putting in, and by so doing, you're building a tidal wave of future prosperity. This is the law of increase. It's understood and followed undeviatingly by every successful business person, artist, professional, and worker, by every successful mother and father and friend. It's the most striking attribute of all successful people, companies, and institutions. Now let's go back to the idea of creating instead of competing. You're the point from which all increase must stem. Not your company, your spouse, your parents, or your friends. You're the creative center of your universe. Increase must come from you personally. Find ways to do the things you do that reflect you and your own unique talents and abilities. If you do this, no other person in the world can operate exactly as you do. You will not be competing with anyone. You'll be creating from within yourself. As you find new and better ways of giving more in use value than you're receiving in money, more and more people will turn to you. You'll find your circle of friends increasing. If you're in business, you'll find it continually growing, expanding. Do this in a quiet and unobtrusive manner. You don't have to shout about how much you're doing for others. They'll recognize it and be drawn to you. One of the most interesting things about such increase is that totally unexpected and wonderful things will begin to occur in your life. People you don't know who have exactly what you need will make their appearance at the right time and in the right place. Everything will begin to dovetail, and your life will take on new meaning and direction and bring you far greater rewards. Let the impression of growth, of increase, mark everything you do. As you do these things, keep constantly before you the vision of what it is you intend to accomplish. Don't worry about it. Don't fret about it. Just know you're going to accomplish it. And following these rules, you can't fail. Dr. Albert Schweitzer once said, "I don't know what your destiny will be, but one thing I do know, the only ones among you who will be really happy are those who have sought and found how to serve." People who have not found a meaningful way to serve tend to be at odds with themselves and their worlds, the so-called empty nest years of millions of middle-aged women, women with a great deal of talent and ability, with a great deal to give, and no place to put it. They putter around the empty house doing simple automatic chores while literally aching for something more meaningful to do, a way of serving that will bring them the contentment and fulfillment and happiness they yearn for. We feel nervous and depressed when we're not being of service. It's what gives meaning to our leisure and gives us a feeling of being needed and important. Every person should ask himself, how can I best marshal my human resources and apply them to a field in which I have interest in a way which will maximize my service? If I can do that, everything else is very likely to fall into place. Millions who find their lives boring, who find themselves depressed, at odds with themselves and others, who find themselves suffering from a restless discontent, called the malaise of our times, should seek ways of being of service. I read recently about a psychological test in which you're supposed to complete 20 statements beginning with the words, "I am." That is, on a sheet of paper, you write down the number one, and behind it write, "I am," and then complete the sentence. You might begin by writing, "I am a human creature." Then on line two, you again begin the statement with, "I am," and make a statement about yourself. You do that 20 times, and before you reach 20, you're making some pretty revealing comments. You're digging for information about yourself. In fact, you're doing what Socrates suggested we do when he said that an unexamined life is not worth living, or words to that effect. And with this method, if in case you're looking for some way of serving, in case you do not now have a very interesting and viable method of service, with this method you might find a clue as to the field or way in which you can make the greatest possible contribution. For by so doing, you're going to reap the greatest possible rewards. I don't think there's any question but that Dr. Schweitzer was correct in his statement. Serving each other is the way to happiness and fulfillment. If you took away the people that we serve, our lives would become meaningless. People, other people, have everything in the world we can possibly want, and they will gladly share it with us if we will serve them to their satisfaction. The real purpose of our journey through life is to find out how best we can serve.
The seemingly different topics of service, giving more than we take, competition, and profit are really tied together better for us now. We prosper by giving value, helping others to prosper in some way. Our desire for increase is a natural one, but in a world structured as a large human network, finding new methods to create within ourselves is vital and far more enriching than simply trying to compete with everyone else. And as great prophets and thinkers have been saying for thousands of years, the good we do for people ultimately comes back to us. Finding new ways to serve others can be achieved by taking a close look at ourselves. Service in very specific areas comes naturally to some people. Others should dig deep to find out how they can best fulfill their potential. Regardless, there are plenty of needs to fill, and filling them will make the world a better place in which to live. This concludes Side 2. Please fast forward the tape to the end to queue up for your next listening. The attitude of personal excellence is one of great expectations. It's an uncompromising approach to life, and certainly a natural extension of our need and desire to serve others. But it goes further than that. Many books and cassettes have appeared recently on the subject of excellence. But in the next few minutes, we'll take a special look at this extraordinary quality that's tough to define, but easy to identify. Earl Nightingale had much to say on this topic. While celebrating innovations in all areas of manufacturing, information processing, and customer service, he was firm in his belief that speed, at the sake of quality, was an unacceptable compromise. He was convinced that a person would enjoy endless success and fulfillment if he chose an area of need, used the time and resources required to fill it in a superb way, and continued to develop new ways of doing it better. This is what he called personal creation of value. In other words, finding meaning through doing something well. Gratitude is a key characteristic usually found in those who practice excellence in their daily lives. They are thankful for the opportunity to do what they do, and they are certainly grateful to those who appreciate their fine work. We all can aspire to the goal of excellence in whatever we do. By throwing ourselves into our ventures and by taking pride in the process and the results, we acquire a fine habit. The attitude of excellence.
Have you ever noticed that when someone calls you on the phone, you immediately form a mental picture of the person? You get not only a mental picture of his face and figure or hers, but a feeling with regard to his or her personality. And that feeling you get is either good or bad. That is, the person affects you either pleasantly or unpleasantly. There's hardly ever a perfectly neutral feeling. It's either favorable or unfavorable. And to carry it a step further, You project a picture in the minds of the people with whom you come in contact. And again, whether it's on the phone or in person, that picture is either favorable or unfavorable. You're projecting these pictures all day long to your children, your marriage partner, the people who serve you, your associates, your boss, everyone, all day, every day. So how's your picture? How do you appear to people passing by on the street? Do you appear happy, unhappy, bored, disinterested, worried, successful, or unsuccessful? The picture you project, the way in which you communicate to every person you come in contact with during the day, is a reflection of your total personality. The picture you project is determined by how you feel inside. The people who project the best pictures are those who know how to be grateful. Their gratitude for what they have, for what they are, kind of radiates about them. They don't worry about what's missing, but are grateful for what's there. They don't concentrate on the shortcomings of their marriage partner or their children. They're grateful just to have them. They look upon problems as things to be solved, and are grateful for the capacity and wisdom to overcome them. These are the people who run deep. More than any other factor, gratitude projects the kind of picture that is irresistible. It attracts men, women, dogs, and cats. It also attracts a condition mistakenly called good luck. These people are easy to recognize. There's a calm, sort of level look to their eyes, and smiling comes as naturally to them as breathing. They don't complain about what's to be done. They simply do it, and do it well, and then start looking around for something else to do. They radiate ability and good cheer like an old-fashioned stove radiates heat on a cold morning. They project a great picture, and the world projects it back to them. Every minute of every waking hour of every day of your life, you're projecting a picture of yourself and your personality, and you can tell how it looks to the world by looking at what you're getting back. One of the truly great things that accrued to the old-time craftsmen and to the few still remaining was the joy that came from the meaning of doing. The feeling of value that pervades a person's whole being when he does something of which he's proud. The woman who knits or does needlepoint, the painter, the writer, the cabinet maker, the really good cook, the workman or woman who creates something of value. And I think that's it. The personal creation of value. You know what I mean? If you do, you know that it's a large part of a person's income, his psychic income, so important to living in good, healthy adjustment. The distinguished social critic Lewis Mumford has written that the fact is that with all of our superabundance, abundance of energy, food, materials, products, there's been no commensurate improvement in the quality of our daily existence. He said the great mass of comfortable, well-fed people in our civilization live lives of emotional apathy and mental torpor, of dull passivity and enfeebled desire, lives that belie the real potentialities of modern culture. He's also pointed out that the fault lies in forcing something that is capable of producing goods in great numbers to produce more and more, more on top of more, more every month, every year, until quality and beauty must be destroyed in the process, until there's so much that we no longer appreciate it. Mumford's concerned, and I think every thinking person will agree with his concern, he's concerned with balance and self-discipline, with the sort of person who will do intelligently and well whatever he turns his hand to, because he understands the meaning of doing, the meaning of value, not only in that to which he turns his hand, but in his life as well. There's meaning in doing something well, anything really. You know, there are no so-called good jobs and bad jobs. Every job holds within it the road to greatness if it's done well, if it can give us the meaning and satisfaction that come from doing a job as well as we can learn to do it. It's wonderful these days when we find a person who does an unusually good job, a waitress, a service station attendant, a mechanic, a salesperson, a carpenter, plumber, other craftsman, an attorney, doctor, whomever. We run into them from time to time, and we never fail to notice and be aware of them, to be grateful to them. Such people always seem happier, more cheerful, and have a much better self-image. They seem to find joy and delight in their work, in their days. They seem to understand that there is meaning in doing what they do as well as they can. They take a few extra pains that
converts what would otherwise be an ordinary job into something special. They stand out like fresh oases in a dismal desert of uninteresting sameness, and they find that the meaning they find in doing brings meaning into their lives. They're happier people because of it. You know them. Perhaps you're one of them. If so, congratulations. You're the member of an exclusive club. James B. Conant, when he was president of Harvard University, commented that each honest calling, each walk of life, has its own elite, its own aristocracy based upon excellence of performance. That's beautiful. People in every field of human endeavor will agree with that remark. Aristotle said, "Excellence is an art won by training and habituation. We do not act rightly because we have virtue or excellence, but we rather have those because we've acted rightly. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. By judging the excellence or the lack of it of our work, we can tell if we're in the right calling. If it's of paramount importance to us to strive for excellence in what we do, chances are we're in the kind of work for which we're best fitted, or at least one of the fields for which we're qualified. One of the problems of the business person is that after developing and profiting from a good idea, he will tend to stay with it in unchanging form too long. For some things, that'll work, but for most things, it won't. They need updating on a regular, annual basis. We need to ask ourselves at regular intervals, a number of times each year, how can we make it better, more efficient? How can we bring it up to the best of present, even future standards? People will cling to an idea as though it's the best, if not the only idea they'll ever get. And when we're creating or building something, are we anticipating the future? A good example of foresight is found in the main streets of towns and cities built by the Mormons when they moved west. They were riding horses and driving wagons then, but they built broad, beautiful streets that easily accommodate the heavy automobile traffic of today. We tend to cling too long to past successes, systems, and methods. If it's working well today, look at it with the future in mind. We're seeing an accelerating rate of change unprecedented in history, and because so many businesses are still living in the past, there are yawning opportunities on practically every side. How many businesses in your town haven't made a single change in 20 years? In some cases, that may work. For example, a fine old restaurant that's perhaps better now than ever because of its age and strict adherence to quality. But the business people of a community owe it to their customers and the community to keep abreast of excellence, to put part of their profits back into the business to accommodate changing times and tastes. As James B. Conant said, each honest calling, each walk of life, has its own elite, its own aristocracy, based upon excellence of performance, and that applies to every field of human endeavor. We can develop habits of excellence in everything we do. We need to think in terms of excellence. We should demand it in what we buy and produce it in what we do.
Perhaps you've seen the kind of rare old business Earl referred to. It seems to stay the way it is because the customers demand it. They demand the old-fashioned service and food because it's always been that way. But even that kind of unusual and quality-oriented business has to change, grow, and develop to keep up with its own standard of excellence. We, too, must be alert for new methods and ideas to keep our endeavors fresh and innovative. The respect for excellence never changes, and one primary ingredient that always goes into the creation of that excellence is time. We'll hear about the masters in several fields who use their time to create incredible value, value which continues to outlast the work and memory of their peers.
There's an old adage in the publishing and printing industry that goes something like this. The quality of your proofreading will be appreciated long after your speed has been forgotten. And the same principle applies to practically everything we do in life. Once we've finished a piece of work, whether it's a book, a symphony, a manufactured product, or even a sales presentation or a speech, the only thing that really counts is the quality and integrity of the completed product. Very few people who see, hear, or experience the finished work will know or even care how rapidly it was put together. The things we treasure in life are most often those things that were not produced in a hurry, and we can see a return to the old ways of quality first and speed second in many of the better products being marketed today. In this era of increasing pressures and tensions, it often seems that we tend to put an unjustified premium on how quickly a given job can be accomplished. And it's a good idea to pause once in a while to remind ourselves that in the final analysis, it's the quality of our work that's most important, not how fast we were able to turn it out. Some of the better furniture houses will keep you waiting months, maybe a year, for the furniture you order. They don't like to keep you waiting, but they won't compromise with quality, so if you want that particular item, you wait. There's a tremendous opportunity in virtually every field for the person of dedication who has the willingness to work, to succeed by turning out a truly quality product. There's a man of my acquaintance who earns all the extra money he can use by working as a handyman. He has back orders stacked a foot high. He charges a good rate for his work, but his work is really first rate. It's excellent. No matter what you might need done around the house, painting or repairing of any kind, he can do it and do it beautifully. As a result, he decides on his own income, he can live where he pleases and work where he pleases. He's got it made. There's nothing in the world that I can think of that cannot be made better, that cannot be improved on. When you find a way to improve on whatever it is, there'll be people waiting to buy it. Quality in a person or a product or a service is sought by everyone. You have only to think of what you'd most enjoy doing and find a way to do it better, to put in more quality, and you just might have everything else you want too. A friend of mine passed along to me an old out-of-print book entitled The Magic of a Name. It's about the beginnings of the Rolls-Royce automobile, written by Harold Nichols and first published in 1938. It makes interesting reading. But the point that underlies the story is the fact that the originator of the Rolls-Royce automobile, Henry Royce, was an indefatigable perfectionist. He didn't invent the automobile, he just wasn't happy with it. He thought it was too noisy, for one thing, and too heavy and inefficient. And so it happened that in Manchester, England, on April 1st, 1904, there came into being a motor car unlike any other that had been seen or heard before. As Harold Nichols put it, save for a gentle foot from its exhaust pipe, it made no noise at all. There was no clatter from the engine, no grinding from the gears and back axle. And this comparative silence in the days when the noise of a motor car had been likened with deadly accuracy to an avalanche of tea trays was something to marvel at indeed. At the wheel of this miraculous machine sat a bearded figure of some 40 years of age whose piercing eyes were lit with a gleam of triumphant concentration. It was Henry Royce, later Sir Henry, the perfectionist. The trade name Rolls-Royce went on to become synonymous with anything excellent or outstanding. The Spitfires of the Battle of Britain in 1940, which had Rolls-Royce engines, were a big factor in winning that war. In fact, there's a beautiful stained glass memorial window at the Rolls-Royce aircraft engine plant commemorating the pilots of the Royal Air Force, and it reads, "Who in the Battle of Britain turned the work of our hands into the salvation of our country." But the point I want to make is that to become successful and outstanding at something, we don't have to come up with something new. We need only find ways of doing it better. If you think about it, it's the key element in virtually all success stories. Hilton Hotels, Holiday Inns, Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's hamburgers, the list is endless. If you want to succeed at something, just do it better. Henry Royce was so wrapped up in the business of producing a superior automobile, he would forget to eat for days at a time and sleep on a bench in the foundry.
A boy was hired to follow him around with a glass of milk and some bread so he wouldn't get sick from malnutrition. He once heard a mechanic make the statement, "Okay, that's good enough." And they almost had to tie him down. Nothing was good enough for him. And his name and the name of his salesman distributor partner, C.S. Rhodes, is a symbol of quality. It's the same in every field. Advertising to zinnia growing. Give it the kind of study and all-out dedication that Royce gave to his cars, and your name will someday stand like some of those I mentioned earlier. I remember reading a few years ago about a Canadian farmer who sold his Stradivarius violin for, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of $60,000. They're worth much more than that now. He sold it back to the same New York City dealer he'd bought it from many years before, and for the same price. The farmer sold his precious violin by the world's most famous violin craftsman because, as he put it, "I'm getting old and I have no children to leave it to." By getting it back into the hands of the dealer, he knew that it would get into the hands of someone who would treasure it as he had. Antonio Stradivari, the Italian violin maker, lived from 1644 to 1737. That's 93 years, a remarkable lifespan at a time when the average life expectancy was perhaps about 30. He lived for his work, and his work has lived on after him ever since. He worked alone, although later in life his sons helped him. His tools were rather primitive by our standards, but that was not important. He put himself and his genius into his work, and his instruments sang with a power and poignancy, a purity that, in the hands of a fine violinist, delighted all who heard them. When he was finished with an instrument and he was sure that it was up to his personal standards, he signed his name to it, and still today, nearly 250 years later, his name is famous the world over, and his fine instruments still are delighting millions. Throughout history, there have been many with similar standards of excellence in many fields. William Shakespeare, Leonardo da Vinci, craftsmen such as furniture maker Thomas Chippendale, silversmith Paul Revere. Everything they did was done exceptionally well. Not because there was any pressure, other than their own insistence on excellence beyond the reach of others of their time. A good violinist can give you the names of other violin makers who are great and whose instruments are cherished. And it's the same in all fields. There are many thousands of craftsmen and women who will not turn out shoddy or even ordinary work and who would be glad to sign their names to their work. The respect for excellence never changes. It still commands the highest price. It's still revered wherever we find it. And the people performing the work have gained for themselves two precious assets. One, they've gained the kind of security that lasts a lifetime, of course. They never need to worry about income. There's always a ready market for the best. And two, their work is a source of satisfaction and joy to them. They derive deep satisfaction from being uncommon people, turning out uncommonly fine products or services. Would you be willing to sign your name to what you do? I think most of us would. Our work, after all, is a kind of mirror of ourselves.
To serve better, push harder, and pull ahead of the pack. To find satisfaction in the performance and completion of a task. And to willingly associate your name and reputation with whatever product or service you offer. These are some of the ways that excellence is manifested on a daily basis by master craftsmen and unskilled workers alike, by both clerks and executives. Coming up in the last section of this volume, Earl offers practical help in developing the kind of personal quality and attitude that you might seek. Having a relaxed approach to life is discussed, as well as why staying on the positive side of a sometimes negative world always pays off. And on the subject of enthusiasm, we'll take a look at why it's important not to lose the luster in what we do. People with good attitudes have many definable traits and characteristics, and we've talked about just a few of them. We've looked at the connection between achievement and service and the role enthusiasm plays in building and spreading a great attitude. That feeling, that attitude we have when we rise each morning, that's the same one we'll get back from our friends, co-workers, family, and usually even the clerk in the clothing store. There's really no personalized how-to manual to go about a life of service, enthusiasm, and excellence. We have to dig and learn and explore our own ways, and it only happens when we decide that it will happen. We'll hear some thoughts from Earl that will help us get started, or that might confirm some of the methods we're already using. You know, there's a luster to a new job or new challenge that's tough to capture, tough to maintain after an initial period. But Earl has 5 stay-on-us-fighting ideas for you, and we'll learn the keys to the most effective, productive kinds of attitudes. He starts off by talking about a conversation with a friend.
His friend got off on the subject that practically everything we see, hear, and read about during the day is of a negative nature. Our morning paper's front page tells us the world is on the brink of destruction. We read of an entire family wiped out at a railroad crossing, of embassies being stoned and burned in far corners of the world. This is the function of the newspaper, and it does a good job. We're not supposed to be ostriches with our heads buried in the sand. But for the most part, the news we get isn't calculated to start the day on exactly an ecstatic note. Then the conversation of most people seems to turn on negative subjects. I had a cup of coffee in a one-arm joint in New York City one morning, and all I heard were people complaining about one thing or another, their problems, and verbally ripping other people up the back. It seems that the conversations of most people center around their aches and pains, or the rotten weather, or their problems at home, or with the people with whom they work. Radio and television commercials often hinge on fear as a motivating factor for buying. Do this, or you won't be one of the gang, or you'll smell bad, or your car will stall, or you'll get a blowout, or you'll ruin a meal, or your teeth will look funny, or you'll have bad breath. Well, that's the way a disproportionate share of our days seems to go. And my friend was saying that all of this tends to hang a bag of uneasy gloom and suspicion over the subconscious mind. You know, the subconscious mind is believed to accept anything that gets through to it as fact. That is, the subconscious mind, which can be and has been compared to the great submerged bulk of an iceberg, while the conscious mind represents only the very small part seen above the surface, this great submerged part of our minds has no reasoning power. It does not say this is true and that is false. It merely accepts what it receives and stores it. So if the premise is true that most of what we hear and see during the days of our lives is of a negative nature, it's little wonder that most people regard life in the world with anxious suspicion, even dread, and often open hostility. They've been submerged by an overwhelming sea of negative, dark gray, frustrating, and fearful facts and suggestions. And this is why each of us needs to remind himself every day of his life that his attitudes, his goals, his work habits, his conscious power to choose between the negative and the positive, the unhappy and the happy, will determine and fashion his world. We can be conscious of the problems of the world, but not be overwhelmed by them. We can solve our own problems and do our best for those it's been given us to serve. We can live happy, productive, and satisfying lives if that's what we make up our minds to do. As the song has it, we have to latch on to the affirmative and eliminate the negative. The world has its problems, but it's the only world we've got. So let's make the best of it. Julius Boros, one of the greatest golfers of all time and a man who proved that at the game of golf you can reach your peak performance after 45, had some wonderful advice some time back, not just for those strange characters who love to play golf, but for everyone. His advice? Of course, his advice was relax. He said, in effect, that when it's your turn to hit the ball, walk up to it and hit it. Don't make a production out of it. Enjoy the game. If you hit a bad shot, go hit it again. When you get ready to putt, putt. Relax and enjoy the game. And at the same time, you'll take strokes off your game. Now, anyone who's ever seen Julius Boros play golf has had to admire his wonderfully relaxed attitude toward the game. When he has a shot to make, he studies the lie, looks to see where he wants the ball to go, selects a club, takes an easy, relaxed stance, and, in what for most people would be a practice swing, 99 times out of 100 puts the ball exactly where he wants it. You've probably noticed how some people seem to be forever at ease, whether they're playing golf, making a speech, or solving a difficult problem, while others seem to make a difficult and tiring production out of everything they do. When we see that there's something that needs to be done, we should relax and do it. If you watch a pro in any field, you'll notice how calm and confident he appears. Even a professional football quarterback with a ton of very serious linemen trying their best to flatten him knows that the minute he tenses up and loses his cool, he's done for. Those who are best in any field are calm, cool, and collected. Whether it's raising kids, working, or getting along well with other people, a relaxed attitude will work like a charm. And this doesn't mean you won't make mistakes. That can't be avoided, but at least you'll make your mistakes in a relaxed, comfortable way. You know, our bodies, our nervous systems, our subconscious minds know how to do things. Years of experience and training are lurking in there. But all too often, we override these valuable assistants to excellence by forcing a tense consciousness on the things we do. This is what makes us miss those 3-foot putts, or send a slice or hook out of bounds, or foul up a job, or send our kids unhappy and hurt out of the room, or make our wives wish they'd been a little choosier in selecting a husband, or our husbands wish they'd been a little choosier in selecting a wife. All because we don't relax. Relax, smile, and cool it. It's a funny thing, isn't it? It's the salesperson with a relaxed, cool attitude who makes the sales. And it's the boss who gets along well with his subordinates, the worker who gets along great with his fellow workers, the neighbor who's liked best and most sought after. Maybe we should have little unobtrusive signs around where we live and work, little signs that read, "Relax." You can be outstanding at what you do, and as a person, by taking a relaxed attitude toward everything you do.
Have you ever thought much about newness? You know, the quality people are talking about when they say a new broom sweeps clean or turn over a new leaf. Well, newness, like most things, has its good side, its bad, depending on how we look at it. A person in a new job, for instance, may feel he's at a disadvantage. He may be nervous, uncertain of just what he's supposed to do or how to do it. Sometimes he's bewildered by all that's going on around him. Maybe he's even a little scared. But even so, the person who's new to a business has a unique advantage over some of the other more seasoned men in his company. His job has a sparkle about it. There's a luster, a challenge in a new job that isn't always present once the position becomes familiar. Do you remember your first day at work? I do. I can remember the first time I sat down in front of a microphone as though it were yesterday instead of a good many years ago. Even though it was a radio station so small they used an old walk-in refrigerator for a studio, to me it was one of the most exciting days of my life. I was scared and nervous, and I sounded like a man with his neck caught in a car door, but I was thrilled, too. How about your job? Does it still hold the excitement it did on that first day? It should, and it can, but does it? One of the commonest mistakes we make is to let the luster fade from our lives. As it does, we gradually lose our enthusiasm, and if we're not careful, we'll settle down into a worn, tired groove of dull, uninteresting habit. We become like oxen yoked to a mill, going around in circles with our eyes fixed only on the worn path of our feet. People who allow themselves to get in a rut usually don't realize that a rut is little more than a grave with both ends knocked out. Now, how can we stay out of this deadly rut? How can we keep our enthusiasm and maintain the luster in our lives instead of allowing it to fade with time and familiarity? The answer lies in reminding ourselves of things we already know but sometimes tend to forget. A Chicago executive once told me how he maintained the luster in his job, how he charged his batteries during the early days of his career. Whenever overfamiliarity with his product and service or the negativism of some of his products prospects or associates began to undermine his enthusiasm for what he was selling, he'd simply make a service call on one of his best customers. There he could reassure himself of the excellent results being realized through the use of his company's products. Then my friend would head out again with renewed confidence in himself, in his ability to be of service, and in the benefits he could deliver to every new prospect. You see, even though the everyday details of our work may seem old hat to us, we should remember that those we serve look forward eagerly to the product or service. A person may be indifferent about many things, but the things he spends his money for aren't among them. We shouldn't be indifferent either, and we won't be if we'll look at our own product or service through the eyes of a happy customer. People are on stage every day, like the actors in a Broadway play. They're sometimes required to say the same words and go through the same basic actions day after day and week after week. The professional actor learns his lines and movements and then performs the part every day, often twice a day, for as long as the play can run. He can never allow himself to become bored with the role, any more than we can afford to become bored with our work. The actor knows his audience is a new one for every performance. What he's doing isn't boring to them. What does the actor do to maintain the enthusiasm, to keep excitement in his acting? He studies and works. He continues to improve his role. He lives his part, constantly refining his timing and movements, forever finding ways to put even greater meaning into the words he must say. All of us are in the people business. Each day we have the opportunity to learn firsthand one of life's most valuable lessons, how to get along well with people, how to make friends of those with whom we work, and how to persuade them to decisions that will benefit both them and ourselves. Our success in most any type of activity will always be an exact ratio to our ability to influence people. And the best way I know to influence people is to care enough, to know enough to serve them well. Sometimes we lose sight of the value of our work, and when we do, we lose the luster, not just from our work, but from our lives. So here are some more luster-restoring ideas you can use right now, and every day from now on. One, understand that anything, no matter how exciting in the beginning, will grow, not may grow, will grow stale in time if we're not careful. Two, keep in mind that fighting off staleness in our lives is a daily job. There's something you can, something you must do every day in order to keep vitality in your performance. It is simply the actor's technique. Live the part. Three, realize that there's no such thing as a job without a future. Every job has a future, just as every person has. Whether that future is great or small depends entirely upon the person holding it. Four, see the big picture. See your work in relation to the whole scheme of things. Your work is important to those you serve. Your success will depend on how well you provide that service. Five, finally keep developing your ability to see yourself and your work through the eyes of that most important person, the recipient. And remember, don't ever lose the luster.
Remember, don't wait for burnout to come along before you start fighting that staleness. Maintaining the luster is a daily job, just like providing your service or product. And we can always have the most influence on people and therefore be assured of success if we care and know enough about them. If we do this, we'll give our very best. In this final segment, Earl discusses those stimulating triggers of enthusiasm that we all need. How turning negative words into words of hope can actually increase our ability for achievement. And how treating your job as the most important one in the world leads to it becoming the most important.
You know where a lot of people make a big mistake? It's in thinking their jobs aren't important. There isn't a job in the world that's not important. If you think it's important and treat it as though it were important, there must be more than 10,000 different jobs, maybe a lot more. But every single one of them can be a very important job if the person doing it treats it the right way. Now, we all know people who treat their work in an unimportant manner, who do just enough to sneak by without too much discredit. Their jobs really are unimportant. But we know people doing the same kind of work who have achieved greatness. This applies as much to the housewife as it does to the senator, to the mail carrier as it does to the chairman of the board in the paneled office. I believe more people should remember what Charles Dickens once wrote. It is well for a man to respect his own vocation, whatever it is, and to think himself bound to uphold it, and to claim for it the respect it deserves. No, there are no unimportant jobs. There are only people who treat their work in an unimportant fashion, and who must then become unimportant people. As they say in show business, there are no small parts, only small actors. There's no such thing as a job that does not contain somewhere within it the key to greatness, the road to great achievement. But we've come to think that some jobs or professions are greater than others. That's not true. The person who delivers your cleaning, who does his job in an outstanding fashion, who thinks about his work, is a better person and a better professional than the physician who does not approach medicine in the same way. Someone once defined luck as being something that happens when preparedness meets opportunity. The man or woman who does his or her job in an outstanding way suddenly finds that luck seems to hang around most of the time. These are the people who develop the real kind of security that no one can take away from them. The inner security that can come only from doing whatever it is given you to do in an outstanding manner. These are the people who are seldom hurt or even bothered by recessions and depressions. When times are bad, we can do without people who have made themselves unimportant. But we must have, we need the outstanding ones. We depend on them, and we know they can be given a job and left alone. We know they'll do it well, and that they'll do more than they have to, more than they're paid to do. In this way, industry makes a profit on their services, and they will always profit from their industry. Do you know as much about your work as a good physician knows about medicine or a good lawyer knows about law? You should. For whatever it is you do, it's your profession, and there are no unimportant jobs unless they're made unimportant by unimportant people. When we use a euphemism, we use a word that is perhaps less expressive or direct, but often less distasteful or less offensive than another. When we say a person has passed away, instead of saying he's died, we're speaking euphemistically. In that particular case, it's less than ideal, but euphemisms properly used can change one's entire outlook on a situation. My old friend Parky Parkinson reminded me that by changing the word problem to project, we can change our attitude toward the situation. The great Arctic explorer, Roald Amundsen, said that he and his men could never have gotten through the situations they faced if they had not given them euphemistic names, the light touch. These euphemisms took some of the strangeness, the hazard, the challenge, even the terror out of their experiences. Now, a problem might seem ominous or threatening, but if we call it a project instead, our approach to it changes. We view it as something that has a solution we're engaged in finding. In the same way, we can remind ourselves that our opportunities are often in exact proportion to our problems. Polio was a problem worldwide, but to Dr. Jonas Salk and his fellow researchers, it was a project on which they were working and which they were successful in solving. Cancer is a problem to millions worldwide, but it's a project to thousands of hardworking people in the sciences, and it will be overcome. When we have a pressing problem, and who's without one for long, I think we need to take this intelligent attitude toward it. This is not a Pollyanna attitude, unless you want to call all the people who've been solving human problems for centuries Pollyannas. It's rather a very human, intelligent attitude. Following an operation one time, I had to go back to my surgeon for checkups, which involved a very painful re-examination of the work he had done. At first, I'd holler and curse and tell him it hurt like you know what, but he would just smile benignly and say, "No, that's stimulating." It still hurt, but thinking of it as stimulating did something to make the situation a bit less serious and painful, and we could laugh about it. What might seem like a forthcoming problem might be termed an adventure instead. Thinking of the move to a strange community and a new job as an adventure could change one's attitude toward it. And it's our attitude toward something that, more than anything else, will determine its successful outcome.
So try changing the words you use for situations normally thought of as bad or threatening or painful to euphemisms, which can give you a more positive outlook. Think of them as projects or adventures and go tearing into them, looking for solutions. It's all a matter of semantics and attitude. Problems are a necessary and unending part of living. Our job is to solve them for as long as we can. And solve them, we do. Reading Bernard Levin's excellent piece in praise of exuberance, which appeared sometime back in the New York Times Magazine, I became concerned anew, as he has, about the general disappearance of exuberance and enthusiasm in the modern world. It reminded me again of the powerful cartoon I saw some years back by the European artist Fernando Kron, in which, in the first panel, he shows a group of small school children entering a street-level subway station. As the children head down for the subway, they're the picture of exuberant joy. They're laughing and playing and tossing hats in the air, as children do. But in the next panel, we see a group of middle-aged adults coming out of a subway station. And they wear the facial expressions of zombies. Their faces display dullness, tedium, and a complete lack of interest or enthusiasm. There's no caption on the drawing, nor is one needed. The question screams out, what happened to these people in the years since childhood that has removed every vestige of their zest for life? In a world filled with wonder and the opportunity for growth and exploration of options, these adults, so representative of big city crowds, and small town people too, have apparently lost every vestige of interest. They're in neutral, a kind of modern limbo we might characterize as survival. What happened? Is it a matter of responsibility, a factor of competition for survival? There's no easy answer, that's for sure. To tell someone he or she should be more enthusiastic is meaningless, unless at the same time stimulating triggers of enthusiasm are brought into the picture. Perhaps the difference is a matter of positioning. Enthusiastic people seem to be on top of life, in control of things, and have a multitude of interests. They're people who tend to be committed to something in which they find enjoyment and challenge and the satisfaction of achievement. If you sit in a cafe and watch the passing crowd outside, you'll see this clear-eyed oasis from time to time. There's a quickness to the step and a brightness in the eyes. If this man or woman were present in that crowd of adults Fernando Kron depicted, he or she would be instantly recognizable. There's energy in such a person, direction, intentionality, and delight. As for the rest, the dull-eyed, the slack-faced plodders, the survivors, we might say, they seem to be in a defensive mode vis-a-vis this business of living. They react to events. They don't cause them. They're like the fighter who's given up any hope of winning and who simply concentrates on defending himself from more serious injury. The enthusiastic people are on top of life, regardless of their status, and the others are on the bottom, and perhaps those on the bottom don't know about getting on top. You know, the word enthusiasm is from the root entheos, meaning the god within. Enthusiastic, exuberant people, rare as they are the ones who make the difference.
Are you on your way out of that modern limbo, that survival mode Earl mentioned? If your aim is set in that direction, put these ideas to work now. Remember that the world reflects back to you the attitude it sees. Find your stimulating triggers of enthusiasm and begin seeing and feeling the difference in your life and the lives of others. Using some of the ideas in this volume, you can stop seeing problem orientation and start acting on project orientation in every phase of your life. And when you find your special area of service, you'll discover new ways to act in that higher plane in that manner of excellence that makes all the difference in the world.